Well, good morning, everybody. Let's see. We're going to open every book but Daniel today. So you might want to open up to Deuteronomy 28. You'll see there's a method to the madness in a moment. Deuteronomy 28, verses 49 and 50. And then you might want to keep a finger over in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 14 and verse 14. The title of our message this morning is, and I worked all week on this, you ready? Introduction to the book of Daniel. That's the best I could come up with. Well, I preached a 4th of July message that ended on October 24th. So we did a lengthy series on voting and the believer's responsibility to vote and things of that nature. And now that we're finished with that topical study, we're moving back into verse-by-verse teaching and taking a look, beginning today, at the book of Daniel. I think one of the mistakes we make as Bible readers is we just charge into a book and start going verse by verse, but we really don't understand why the book is here. We don't really understand what the background of the book is. And so typically, and I've followed this pattern ever since I began teaching at this church, every book I've ever introduced or taught, I've always done an introduction to it. So what I'd like to lead you through are what I call the building blocks. These are the foundational stones, if you will, that are necessary to understand the book of Daniel. As you grow in appreciation for these foundation stones, the Bible starts to come into focus, and you start to understand what this book of the Bible is doing here. So here are the foundation stones I want to walk with you through very briefly this morning. The first is the diversity of topics. This is kind of a whet your appetite type of slide. Why should we, in the year 2000 and, 2016? Why in the world would we be studying a book written 2,600 years ago, back in the 6th century BC? I mean, what is actually here for us? Well, if you give yourself to the book of Daniel, there are several things you start to learn. Here's a few. Number one, prophecy. You say, well, what is prophecy? Prophecy is history in advance. The Bible reveals historical information before it happens. And Daniel, of course, is known for this. The second is a fancy word there called eschatology. Eschatos means end. Ology means what? The study of. Eschatology is the study of the end. You say, well, isn't that prophecy? Not necessarily. Because you see, many of the prophecies of the Bible have already been fulfilled. Think how many prophecies were fulfilled in the life of Christ. But there is a branch of prophecy that is yet to come, and we call that eschatology, the systematic study of what the Bible reveals concerning the future. And obviously the book of Daniel has a great contribution to make to the subject of eschatology. And something else you'll walk away with, if you give your mind to the study of Daniel, you'll walk away with confidence that the Bible is the Word of God. I'm the type of person that can't just believe something just because someone tells me to believe it. I have to have facts. I have to have evidence. And what I have discovered is the book of Daniel gives me that evidence, because only God knows the end from the beginning. Only God could have revealed the future so clearly to Daniel. And this is what distinguishes the Bible from virtually any other religious holy book on the horizon today. No other book reveals the end from the beginning the way the Bible does. you kind of get the impression that the God who knows the end from the beginning authored this book. Something else you walk away with is a knowledge of the intertestamental period. You say, what in the world is that? Well, it's the time period between the testaments. You know, when you close the book of Malachi, Persia is in control. The Jewish people are speaking Hebrew. Aramaic is the known language of the day. You open the pages of the New Testament, and Rome is in power. And the language of the day would be Greek. And you say, well, wait a minute, what happened between Malachi and Matthew? What happened between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament? The answer is a lot. 400 years, that's a long time. That's almost double the size of the length of the United States of America. And without a knowledge of the intertestamental period, you don't understand the transition between the two testaments. The interesting thing is Daniel fills out that time period for us. But he does it 400 years before it happened. So the better you understand the prophecies of the book of Daniel, the better you can bridge that gap between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. Something else you walk away with is an understanding of angelology, which is the doctrine of the angels. The Bible tells us that there are myriads of angels, 10,000 times 10,000. And it's astonishing to discover how active the angels are in our daily lives without us even being aware of it. The angels are used constantly by God to dispatch and accomplish His purposes on the earth. Angels are huge in the book of Daniel. In fact, we're going to run into two of them by name. One is named Michael and one is named Gabriel, and they do different things. We also, from the book of Daniel, walk away with an understanding of spiritual warfare, because Paul writes in Ephesians 6 and verse 12, for our struggle is not against what? Flesh and blood. But against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Whether you understand it or not, or accept it or not, the moment you place your personal faith in Christ for salvation is the moment you inherited three enemies that you didn't have before. And these enemies actually will tag team on you and gang up on you. They are the world, the flesh, and the devil. And nothing reveals that better than the book of Daniel, specifically chapter 10, because there's a scene there where an angel, who I think is Gabriel, is dispatched from heaven to answer Daniel's prayer request. And yet that prayer request, you see this in Daniel 10:13, Daniel 10:20 and 21, that prayer request was not answered for 3 weeks or 21 days. Have you ever wondered why your prayer requests are not answered immediately? The explanation is given in Daniel 10. The angel, Gabriel, dispatched from heaven to answer Daniel's prayer requests, was held up through a battle with a fallen angel called the Prince in Power over Persia. And these two angels literally duked it out for 21 days. And finally, God sent another angel to help the first angel, and they ganged up on the angel from Persia, and the initial angel got through and answered Daniel's prayer request, and now the angel says, you know what, now that I've answered your prayer request, I've got to go fight my way out. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and rulers of this dark world. That's why we're told to put on the full armor of God. Nothing reveals the spiritual conflict that we are in, perhaps better than the book of Daniel. What else do you walk away with from the book of Daniel? How to live for God in a pagan society. Because the storyline of the book of Daniel unfolds not while the nation of Israel is resting comfortably in the land of Israel. They have been removed from their land by the hand of God, 350 miles to the east, in a place called Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. They're away from the temple, they are away from the religious system, they are away from everything they knew. And they're living on pagan turf. And how in the world do you live for God in that kind of a society? The book of Daniel, through its various stories, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the lion's den, in the fiery furnace, Daniel in the lion's den, other stories are role models for how Israel is to live in a pagan society. And beloved, let me just say something. America has become a Romans 1 culture. The United States of America was founded on a Christian base. This, in fact, is a citation from the United States Supreme Court in 1892, a unanimous decision declaring that America is a Christian nation. Supreme Court. Not someone's opinion, but the jurists. After going through multiple historical precedents. That same Supreme Court in 1963 said, if portions of the New Testament are read, it could be in the public schools, it could be psychologically harmful to the child. Something happened in between 1892 and 1963. The Judeo-Christian moorings of America were removed. And we are living in the aftermath of that. We are not living any longer in a Christian nation. We are living in a pagan nation. I call it a Romans 1 culture, where our biblical beliefs and assumptions are no longer the majority opinion. So that raises an interesting question. If you still believe in all of those truths of the Bible, how are you supposed to live? The answer largely is given in the book of Daniel as we watch Daniel and his three friends under that same circumstance. We follow their example, which we'll be talking about. Something else you learn about in the book of Daniel is God's sovereignty over empires. God is in control of what empire comes into existence, how long it lasts, and the next empire. And I think we need a little dose today of the sovereignty of God. Particularly as we're on the precipice of a national election where everybody's biting their nails, what's going to happen? Well, here's my prediction. You ready? The person that wins is the person that is supposed to win. That's my prediction. Because God is the one that sovereignly allows political leaders to come into existence. Daniel 2:21 says of God, He removes kings and establishes kings. Whoever we get somehow is there because God put them there. I don't know why. Maybe as an instrument of grace, maybe as an instrument of discipline. You know, the funny thing about God is He never consults me either when He makes His decisions. He just moves His little tiny finger and does it. But Andy, what about the liberal media bias? Andy, what about voter fraud? I'm sure God up there is real worried about voter fraud. I'm sure He's real worried about the liberal media being a little bit facetious there. God is in control completely. And, everybody today is talking about this is the most important election in American history, and everybody's nervous, and everybody's getting mad at each other on social media and fighting back and forth. And the fact of the matter is we need to step back and get a heavy dose of the sovereignty of God and kind of get over ourselves a little bit. We're not that important. The book of Daniel is a reminder of this. And so as you give yourself to the book of Daniel, you start to discover all of these truths. The second building block is the date. When was this book actually written? Well, what you'll discover is there's a big fight on that amongst the theologians. There are those that argue for a second century date. What I mean by second century is second century BC, 200 years before the time of Christ, this book was written. There are others, like myself, that say, no, the book was not written in the second century. It was written in the sixth century BC, 600 years before the time of Christ. Well, what difference does it make if it's written 200 years before the time of Christ or 600 years before the time of Christ? Who really cares? It's a big deal. Why? Because there's a motivation behind people that will not assign an early date to the book. Here's the motivation. Daniel says a bunch of things about the intertestamental time period that came to pass with great precision. How could Daniel have known all of that 400 years before it happened? And those that have an anti-supernatural bias look at that and they say, this just can't be. And so what they do is they drag the book of Daniel 400 years into the future and they make it look like Daniel is giving a history lesson rather than a prophecy. And they come up with arguments that they use to support their view. And I kind of listen to their arguments and I say to myself, is that your A game? Is that all you can bring? I mean, I watch the History Channel, A&E, Mysteries of the Bible, all these people, PhDs from Harvard, they're going to come out and disprove the book of Daniel. I listen to it and I say, is that the best you've got? One of the arguments that they use is Daniel is placed in what is called the Kethabim. I am ending means plurality. The Jews did not organize what we call the Old Testament the way we Protestants do. They organized it by what's called Tanakh, T-N-K. T stands for Torah, first five books of the Bible. N stands for Nabim, which basically means prophets. Kethabim stands for writings. And you'll discover that Jesus Christ in Luke 24:44 talked about those three divisions of Hebrew Bible. He says, the whole Hebrew Bible points to me in the law of Moses, that's the T for Torah, the prophets, that's the N for Nabim, and the Psalms, which was the most prominent book in the Kethabim or the writings. And what people say is, well, Daniel is not placed in the prophetic section, it's placed in the writing section. So therefore, Daniel is not like Isaiah and Jeremiah and all those guys that wrote very early. He must have written later. That's their argument. Which to me is basically no argument at all. The reason Daniel is not placed in the Nabim, but is placed in the Kethabim, is because Daniel really doesn't read like the book of Isaiah, or Jeremiah, or Ezekiel. It's got interwoven into it prophecies and narrative stories. You don't have anything like this that predominates Isaiah or Jeremiah. That's why the Jews put it in the Kethabim. They didn't put it in the Kethabim because they were trying to make a statement about the late date of the book of Daniel. But the arguments for an early date are so much better. I had you turn to Ezekiel 14 and verse 14. Ezekiel is writing in the 6th century. Did you know that Ezekiel mentions Daniel? It says in Ezekiel 14, verse 14, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in the midst, by their own righteousness, they could only deliver themselves, declares the Lord. Isn't it interesting that Ezekiel knew about Daniel? Well, how could he have known about Daniel if Daniel wrote 400 years later than Ezekiel? In Ezekiel 14, verse 20, you'll see another reference that Ezekiel makes to Daniel. And Ezekiel 28 and verse 3, you'll see the same thing. It's obvious that Daniel was a man who lived in the 6th century because Ezekiel, who also lived in the 6th century, knew of Daniel by way of reputation. Daniel's reputation preceded him, which is a great compliment to his character, which we can throw in a few applications here and there. Does your reputation precede you? Does my reputation precede me? When people think of my name or your name, what are they thinking of? Godliness and holiness? Or, oh no, here comes trouble. Daniel had a great reputation, and Ezekiel makes reference to that. Something he couldn't have done if Daniel hadn't even lived yet. Which raises another interesting point. Who wrote the book of Daniel? This has to do with what we would call authorship. Well, it depends on what date of the book of Daniel you hold to. The late date, here's a fancy word. I paid a lot of tuition money to learn these fancy words, so I've got to use them on somebody. The late date of Daniel is called, here we go, the Maccabean pseudepigraph theory. What does that mean? Well, you recognize the word pseuda, pseudo, which means false, graph, which means writer, a false writer. Maccabean is simply means the empire that was in place when Daniel allegedly wrote this, the time of the Maccabees, which we'll be talking about in this study because the Maccabees are predicted by Daniel 400 years in advance. But there are those that don't believe God can know the end from the beginning. So obviously someone forged the writing. That's what pseudepigraph means, forgery. It was not written by Daniel, but someone using the pen name Daniel after the real Daniel died. So if you hold to a late date of Daniel, you are simultaneously denying authorship, Danielic authorship of the book of Daniel. I, obviously, because I hold to an early date of Daniel, don't believe that. I think Daniel wrote the book of Daniel. I mean, isn't it sad that we're living in a time period where you have to actually come out and defend the idea that Daniel wrote Daniel? Daniel 12 and verse 4 says this, God speaks to Daniel, "But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book." You get the impression that Daniel was writing down the words in a book. I also agree with Jesus. Isn't that a good practice to agree with Jesus? Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus says this, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation," a very important prophecy, by the way, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, he's quoting there Daniel 9:27, "standing in the holy place, let the reader understand." Jesus quotes Daniel 9:27 and doesn't say this was written by the Maccabean pseudepigraph. He says this was written by Daniel. All things considered, Daniel was not written in the 2nd century, it was written in the 6th century. All things considered, this book is not a forgery. This book was actually written by the prophet Daniel during the time period in which he lived. Which takes us now to another building block, another fancy word, ready? Literary genre. What is a genre? Genre basically refers to a species or a kind. It's a French word, actually, and it asks the question, what kind of literature are we dealing with here? Because, you know, when I read the book of Daniel, it sure doesn't read like the book of Romans. There's obviously a different style of literature. Romans is a letter. Daniel seems to be something different. Here's, I think, the proper literary genre. Most of the book of Daniel is narrative. What is narrative? Narrative is rehearsing the story that took place, much like reading the book of Genesis. Most of chapters 1 through 7, now there might be some exceptions there in 2 and 7, which I'll tell you about, but most of chapters 1 through 7 are what we would call narrative, simply telling the story of who Daniel was, who his three friends were, and how they wound up in Babylonian captivity. Once you move into chapters 8 through 12, the style of writing changes, where now Daniel is giving prophecies, predictions, oracles, if you will, of the future. Some of those prophecies, as we look back at them in the year 2016, have transpired. Others are yet to come. The part of it that's transpired we call prophecy. The part of it yet to come we call what? Eschatology. Now, why in the world did I have you open up to the book of Deuteronomy in a study of the book of Daniel? Well, the answer to that is that's what my professor, J. Dwight Pentecost, made me do. When I first arrived at Dallas Seminary, I was so excited to take this class that he was offering as an elective called Daniel Revelation. He walked in the room. I had followed his writings for years, almost an idol of mine. And he said, open up to the book of Deuteronomy. I thought maybe he was getting a little, you know, senile, D, Deuteronomy, D, Daniel, both start with letter D. But what he did for me was such a life-changing thing. It was so beautiful because he linked the book of Daniel to the covenants of God. You cannot understand the book of Daniel. You really can't understand any book of the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, without a foundation in the covenants that God made with the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In Genesis 15, we run into a Hebrew word, I believe you pronounce that berit, berith, which refers to a covenant. God contractually binds himself to do certain things for the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Specifically, God promises these people three things. Number one, land, which is basically a tract of real estate from modern-day Egypt to modern-day Iraq. Number two, descendants that were innumerable. And number three, personal blessing. And God, as you see from this PowerPoint slide, comes along later in biblical history and never changes that covenant. He just adds clarity to it. The land is amplified in the land covenant, Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The Davidic amplifies the seed promises. The new covenant amplifies the personal blessings. The two things to understand about the Abrahamic covenant, both begin with the letter U, is the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional, number one, and number two, unfulfilled. If you can understand unconditional and unfulfilled, the Bible will start to make sense. The hand of God as it moves in history will start to make sense. Because when God makes a promise, remember the movement Promise Keepers? I hate to rain on the parade, there's only one Promise Keeper, and that's God. When God makes a promise, he moves heaven and earth to fulfill the promise. Abraham didn't just have a promise from God, he had a contract, a covenant. God obligated himself to do three things, land, seed, and blessing. The rest of the Bible is God just vindicating what he said he was going to do. When the Abrahamic covenant was entered into, Abraham, and you can read all about this in Genesis 15, followed a ritual whereby animals were severed and arranged in two parallel rows. This was a common way covenants were entered into in that time. The parties to the covenant passed through the animal pieces. And the parties were saying, if we don't fulfill our obligations under the terms of the covenant, then symbolically we are to be torn in two. The way these animals have been torn in two. That's why when you entered a covenant of this solemn nature, you were as good as dead because your life was no longer your own. You lived to fulfill the covenant. What's so interesting about this, Genesis 15, is God put Abram to sleep. And God alone, as represented by the oven and the torch, passed through the animal pieces. And God is saying, if these promises of land, seed, and blessing do not materialize, then let me, God himself is saying, be torn asunder as these animals have been torn asunder. That is the solemn nature of the Abrahamic covenant. And that's why, beloved, you can never get rid of Israel from the equation. It doesn't matter how wicked Israel becomes. It doesn't matter how Christless they become. God has made an obligation contractually to fulfill his purposes through these people, the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is why the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah 31, verses 35 through 37, says this: as long as there's sun, moon, and stars, Israel will always be a nation before me. God speaking that through the prophet Jeremiah. That prophecy was given while the nation of Israel was at the height of disobedience. In fact, they were about to go into the Babylonian deportation because of discipline. And they were just doing little sins, you know, small ones, like throwing your kids into a fire to satisfy a god named Molech. You can't get more Christ-rejecting and God-hating than the way these people became. And yet, God, through Jeremiah, says, as long as there's sun, as long as there's moon, as long as there's stars, Israel will be forever before me as a nation. Even when they're in discipline, they're my people. So, if you want to get rid of Israel, you don't aim your rockets and tanks and bombs at Israel. You aim your missiles at the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because as long as that fixed order remains, Israel will always have the protective care and hand of God upon them. And that covenantal structure, you can try to find it anywhere in history, has never been completely fulfilled. In fact, that dark area is what Israel got under Joshua. That lighter area is everything yet to come. But let me tell you something. Whom the Lord loves, the Lord what? Chastens. And this is why he brought them to Mount Sinai after 400 years of captivity in Egypt, and he entered into another covenant with the nation of Israel a full 6 centuries after the Abrahamic covenant had been entered into. This is called the Mosaic covenant. Notice, if you will, Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. Now, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples of the earth. For the earth is mine, and you shall be to me as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. This is different, is it not, than the Abrahamic covenant? This is the Mosaic covenant. You see the if-then language? What is an unconditional covenant anyway? An unconditional covenant, like in the Abrahamic covenant, is a promise that God will make good on regardless of whether the other parties or party fulfills conditions. Not so the Mosaic covenant. It is conditional. For this covenant to come into blessing, the nation of Israel must obey God. What does this whole thing look like? Can I throw a fancy word at you? An unconditional covenant with a conditional blessing. That's what it is. An unconditional covenant. You look at the whole thing, it's an unconditional covenant, but with a conditional blessing. Israel will always be the owner of land, seed, and blessing, but for a generation to enter into the blessings that they own, to enjoy the blessings that they own, it requires the fulfillment of a condition, the satisfaction of the Mosaic covenant. There's a world of difference between ownership and possession. I could own a beach house in the Hamptons. Let's pretend I do. I don't. But I am so busy working, I don't have time to possess or enter or enjoy. I'm just an owner, but not an enjoyer. Because the nation of Israel is in disobedience, she owns these blessings, but she never enters those blessings to their maximum state, enjoys those blessings until she complies with the covenant at Mount Sinai. The Mosaic covenant is given, and it's articulated in Exodus 19 through chapter 24. And can I throw some more fancy words at you? This is a covenant that is known as a suzerain vassal treaty. Don't let those words frighten you. Suzerain. S, think of superior. Vassal, think of inferior. A common covenantal structure where a superior, the suzerain, who in this case would be who? God, enters into a covenant with an inferior, a vassal, who in this case would be who? The nation of Israel. And the suzerain says to the vassal, if you obey the covenant text, then I will bless. If you disobey the covenant text, I will curse. So the nation of Israel is under a system whereby they remain God's chosen people forever. But whom the Lord loves, the Lord chastens. The Mosaic covenant itself explains the chastening that comes, or the blessing that comes, if Israel is in compliance with the covenant text, which in this case would be the Ten Commandments. It's very similar to your relationship with the Lord. We teach at this church, once saved, always saved. We believe very strongly in the doctrine of eternal security. In fact, we're teaching a Sunday school lesson on that. We're moving really fast. We're up to part 37. Encourage you to come early and attend that. So I am God's, and I'll always be God's, but guess what? What happens when I step out of line? Whom the Lord loves, the Lord what? Chastens. It's the same sort of relationship that Israel had with God as a nation. His chastening can be very severe, but it cannot cut Israel's loose, cut her cord, and disown her. In fact, the Bible tells us the fact that we are disciplined by God is proof that He loves us. It's proof that He owns us. So in the Mosaic Covenant, you have this suzerain vassal treaty. It fits the book of Deuteronomy fits the exact same characteristics of suzerain vassal treaties going back to the time of Moses that we know from archaeology. There's always a preamble, a historical prologue tracing the relationship between the two parties. And then there's the covenantal obligations. What does the vassal have to do? And then there is storage and reading instructions. And God told the nation of Israel to store the covenant text where? In the ark. And He gave them instructions related to how periodically to read the law. Exactly what you have in ancient suzerain vassal treaties. Then there was always witnesses called. But who could be God's witness? God says, I'll call heaven and earth as my witnesses. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 1. And then comes the spine of the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 28. Which is why I had you open to Deuteronomy 28, which is a blessings and curses section. The blessings are given in Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 14. Israel, if you obey the covenant text, here's what you can expect to happen. You will lend, but not borrow. You will go out and fight your enemies against overwhelming odds, and you will win. You will be the head and not the tail. You will be in a place of prosperity and not poverty. Now, do you notice this chapter? The blessings only go on for 14 verses. You get to verse 15, all the way through the end of the chapter, and it's curse after curse after curse that the nation would physically and materially experience as they went into disobedience. Notice, if you will, Deuteronomy 28, verse 15, "But if it shall come about that you do not obey the Lord your God to observe all His commandments and His statutes with which I charge you today, all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, cursed shall you be in the country, cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, cursed shall be your offspring of your body and the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herd and the young of your flock." And it goes on and on and on like this. We call these the cycles of discipline. These cycles of discipline would mount almost like a rolling snowball, getting larger and larger and larger. And finally, at the height of it, God says, "Here's what I'm going to do." That's why I had you turn to Deuteronomy 28, 49 through 50. At the height of it all, "The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance who will have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young." What is going to happen is I'm going to bring a pagan power against you that will displace you from your land. And this becomes the spine of the Old Testament, explaining why the Old Testament reads like it does. You know, the law of God, the Mosaic Covenant, says a king is not to place himself above the law, he is to place himself below the law. He is not to multiply wives, he is not to multiply wives for himself. Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20. What did Solomon, the third king of the United Kingdom, do? It's almost like he woke up one day, read Deuteronomy 17, and did the opposite. He put himself above the law. He multiplied wives. He multiplied wealth for himself. And so God, as He promised all the way back in the time of Moses, brought discipline, and the kingdom was divided the moment Solomon left the throne. And that's why when you go through the Old Testament, you'll see two kingdoms. The northern kingdom, consisting of 10 tribes, took on the name Israel. The southern kingdom, taking on the name Judah, consisting of 2 tribes, Benjamin and Judah. North, south. Capital of the north, Samaria. Capital of the south, Jerusalem. The north didn't do so well. In fact, the north had 19 kings. Not a single king was ever called good in the north. Now, if your team is going 0-19, you're not having the best season. So God made good on what He said He would do through Moses 700 years later. Earlier, rather, He brought a nation that spoke a foreign tongue called the Assyrians, and they dispersed the north. They became scattered, the scattered 10 tribes. Now, you would think the south would have learned what happened to the north and straightened up. Not so. The south actually became worse. And God finally brought the south into judgment, into captivity, by the Babylonians in 586 B.C., You'll notice that God had more grace on the south than the north. They lasted 170 years longer. They were not scattered. They were brought into captivity, into a single geographical location in Babylon. They had 20 kings, and at least they had 8 good kings, quasi-good. A lot of them did good things, but did bad things too. So what you see is the hand of God extending the south greater grace. Now, why would God do that? Because of a prophecy that he made all the way back to the time of Jacob in Genesis 49 and verse 10, which says the Messiah is going to come through which tribe? Judah. That would be in the south. And that's why God is preserving the south, giving additional grace to the south, because the south has to be in place to give birth to the Messiah, Jesus Christ, several centuries later. Nebuchadnezzar, the instrument that God used to bring the south into captivity, was nobody's fool, let me tell you. This man had a strategy, and what he said is, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to take down the south, Judah and Jerusalem, in one foul swoop. I'm going to do it in three waves. The first wave, I'm going to come and I'm going to take the best and the brightest. So he came in 605 BC under one of the final kings of Judah named Jehoiakim, and that's when Daniel, as a very young man, is brought into Babylonian captivity. And Nebuchadnezzar has a game plan. I've got the best and the brightest. I'm going to brainwash him. That's what's going on in Daniel 1. They're learning all the literature of the Chaldeans because I'm going to get them on my side so they talk the rest of the population into coming along peaceably. Which is a great strategy of the devil, by the way. You just get the best and the brightest on your side and the rest will fall into place. They can be talked into anything. And then later in 597, Nebuchadnezzar comes again, and this time the king in Judah was Jehoiachin, and this time Nebuchadnezzar took the majority, about 10,000 people, into Babylonian captivity. And that's when the prophet Ezekiel goes into captivity in the second deportation. And then with the hard work done, Nebuchadnezzar comes back in 586. Zedekiah is the last ruling king over Judah, and Nebuchadnezzar comes and destroys the remnant, what's left of the remnant. He destroys the temple and the sanctuary, something the Jews thought could never happen, because that's where the Shekinah glory of God was once. And yet Ezekiel traces the departure of the Shekinah glory of God and how Nebuchadnezzar took that temple apart piece by piece. And Jeremiah during this time writes a book called Lamentations. Why is it called Lamentations? Because he's lamenting. He's lamenting what has happened. And so this is why when you open the pages of the book of Daniel, the nation of Israel is not in Israel. They are 350 miles to the east in a place called Babylon. And in that time period, which basically lasts 70 years, Jeremiah is very clear in Jeremiah 25:11 and 29:10 that the captivity will last exactly 70 years. God raises up two men. One of them is named Daniel, the other one is named Ezekiel. And they are the exilic prophets, if you have good eyes there, prophesying in that space or gap of time. Their whole ministries took place while the nation, particularly Judah, is in captivity. See, how can you understand the captivity? How can you understand what's happening without that background? That's why Dr. J. Dwight Pentecost, when he opened with Deuteronomy and not Daniel, gave me a gift. He put into my hands the keys by which the scripture can be understood and unlocked. And you see, that's what I'm trying to give to you. I'm trying to help us understand that the nation of Israel has not been severed from God. The Abrahamic covenant won't allow that. But whom the Lord loves, the Lord chastens. That's the outworking of the cycles of discipline. That is the outworking of the Mosaic covenant. That's why Israel, or Judah particularly, is in captivity when the book of Daniel opens. So that takes us now to the message of the book. What is this book about? Simply put, this book is about a period of time that has never been revealed prior, called a mystery, called the times of the Gentiles. It's a period of time when the nation of Israel will have no king reigning on David's throne, Zedekiah being the last. And the nation of Israel is going to be trampled down by various Gentile powers, which are detailed for us in chapter 2 and chapter 7 in the form of two visions. And the nation of Israel will be bullied by the Gentile nations of the earth, trampled down. But one of these days, the times of the Gentiles will end. Jesus will return at the end of the Great Tribulation. He will rule from David's throne. Matthew chapter 25, verse 31 indicates that. He will set up his kingdom through the Jewish people, and the times of the Gentiles will be over. So what you have to understand, and as we speak today, the nation of Israel is in the times of the Gentiles. They're still in it. There isn't anybody that's more pro-Israel than probably myself. I've even tried to look at my family tree. You know how you can do that on the internet these days to see if I've got some kind of Jewish blood in me. I'm so exuberant about the nation of Israel. I just love the Jewish people. But having said that, while we should bless the Jewish people, what you have to understand that the nation of Israel today, as a Christ-rejecting nation, is under the discipline of God. God has not cast them aside. He can't. The Abrahamic covenant won't allow God to do that. But He can put them through severe discipline, something that they're under now. And God, who never leaves the earth without a witness of Himself, begins in Acts 2 to raise up the church, which is us. The church consists of all people who have trusted by faith in the Messiah that national Israel rejected. We are a new man. And one of these days, the church age will be over. I think God has laid the foundation of the church. From my point of view, He's putting on the roof. But the very last Gentile that's supposed to come into the church age will believe. The body of Christ will be complete. The church will be removed from the earth. And then God will put His hand back on national Israel and make good on every promise He has ever made to them, even bringing them to faith in the midst of unparalleled distress. Daniel doesn't talk about the church. Paul does. But the concept of the times of the Gentiles is laid out very clearly in the book of Daniel. In fact, that's why God raised Daniel up, to explain this time period. And more importantly than that, how are you supposed to live in this time period? That's what chapter 1, chapters 3 through 6 are there. Because we have role models of what Daniel did in a pagan society. Here was his basic modus operandi. No compromise. In every area. No compromise. And even though I can die, I'm going to trust my life and my circumstances to God. Oh, and how God came through for Daniel and his three friends over and over and over again. What compromise are you involved in your life? What are you not trusting God for? Can't God come through for you the same way He came through for Daniel and his three friends? See, that's the application to us. So the entire purpose of the book of Daniel is there to encourage Judah by emphasizing the sovereignty of God during the Babylonian captivity and to teach Judah how to live while they're outside the land. The law of God taught Israel how to live while they were inside the land. We're in a different era now. Now they're outside the land. What do we do now? You follow the example of Daniel and his three friends. Because although it's painful, although it's uncomfortable, although you're under discipline, although Babylon is now in power, God has not lost control of this. In fact, the only reason Babylon exists is because of the sovereign purposes of God. That's what the book of Daniel is here for. The whole concept of the book is encouragement during a time of discipline. And this is the great problem that we have as Bible readers. We bifurcate the book of Daniel. When most Christians think of the book of Daniel, they think of their Sunday school days where their Sunday school teacher on a flannel board somewhere told them the story of Daniel in the lion's den. And then when they think of the book of Daniel, they think of the last prophecy conference that they went to, where all of these so-called experts were giving their opinions about the 10 toes of Daniel 2. In fact, I've listened to some of those explanations. Some of those explanations are so detailed that these folks can not only tell you about the 10 toes, they can tell you about the 10 toenails. So people think of the book of Daniel as complicated prophecy and stories. What they miss is the whole message. Everything in the book, whether it's a story of history or a prophecy, is there to show them that God is in control, God is in charge. And so we ought to see the whole book for what it is, rather than bifurcating it in our minds the way we do. Which leads us to another point. How do you outline this book? You ever studied the veins on the leaves of the tree so intently that you forget what the forest looks like? We do that a lot in Bible study, don't we? Bible churches are the worst at this. We're so detail-oriented that we lose sight of the big picture. An outline of the book gives you the big picture. You know, I had a friend of mine, when I was living in Dallas. The two of us became friends. He was a longtime resident of Dallas. And he said, you know, when I drove around Dallas, when I first came to this city, I used to get lost all of the time. And then one day it dawned on me how this city is structured, how this city is set up. And I began to develop in my mind not a street-by-street understanding of the city, but an aerial shot. And once I understood the big picture, I understood where I was supposed to go. I never got lost again. You know, I used to get upset with some of my basketball coaches because I didn't think they saw things correctly. So they would put me on the bench. I didn't do something right. I didn't like that very much. Spent a lot of time on the bench, by the way. And then one day I got injured. So I had to sit at the bleachers at the top of the gym where I could watch the team practice. I could watch the team play games. And when I saw that, I wasn't just focused on my own position and myself. I could see the whole game of basketball. What a different view that is. Then I began to understand why the coach put me on the bench. I wasn't fitting into the system that you need to win basketball games. And see, that's what we're like with the Bible. We're so focused on a detail here and there, we don't see the big picture. So what is the big picture? Well, here's the outline I used to use. Chapters 1 through 6 is the narrative section. Chapters 7 through 12 is the prophetic section. There's a little problem with that. Chapters 2 through 7 are in a different language called Aramaic. The rest of the book, chapter 1, chapters 8 through 12, is in Hebrew. This outline interrupts the Aramaic section. So here's, I think, the right outline of the book. Chapters 1 through 7, part 1. Chapters 8 through 12, part 2. In part 1, Daniel interprets his own visions. He speaks of himself in the third person, and he's primarily talking about the Gentile nations. Chapter 1 is in Hebrew. Chapter 2 is what we would call an Aramaic chiasm, which is a strange method of literature to the Western mind, but it's very common in biblical times. It's arranged like an X. It gets the word chiasm from the Greek word chi, which looks like an X. And what you have is this. The beginning and the end of that section line up. And then you move in a little bit. The second section lines up with the second to last section. Then you move in a little bit more. The third section lines up with the third to last section. And the point of the chiasm is right there in the middle. That's why Daniel 2 through 7 is in Aramaic. It's giving us a chiastic structure. Chapter 2 lines up with chapter 7. Chapter 3 lines up with chapter 6. Chapter 4 lines up with chapter 5. What is God doing in chapter 2? He's giving an outline of the empires that will trample Israel down during the times of the Gentiles. My goodness, that's the exact same thing that happens in chapter 7. Except in chapter 2, it looks like an image made of precious metal. Because it's from the vantage point of Nebuchadnezzar who's doing the trampling. Daniel sees the same thing in the form of four ferocious, disgusting beasts. He's giving the Jewish point of view because he and his people are being trampled upon. Then you move into chapter 3 and it lines up with chapter 6. What's the topic in both? Civil disobedience. Is it ever right to disobey the government? I was asked that in our Bible and Voting series, and the answer is, hold the question, because we're going to be getting to it in the book of Daniel. Daniel 3 and Daniel 6 answer that question. They disobeyed government when government contradicted God, and they were willing to risk their lives in doing it. Chapter 3 is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego doing it. Chapter 6 is Daniel doing it in the lion's den, and then you move into the interior of the chiasm, and God is revealing himself to a Gentile king. The first king of Babylon, when Babylon came to power over Jerusalem, chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar, God reveals himself to Nebuchadnezzar. And then God reveals himself to the last king of Babylon before Babylon was overtaken by the Persians, a man named Belshazzar in chapter 5. Chapter 4 is grace on a Gentile king. Chapter 5 is judgment on a Gentile king. It's chiastically organized. Then we move into, that's supposed to be Roman numeral 2, part 2 of the book, the prophetic section, where now an angel does the interpreting, not Daniel. Daniel speaks of himself not in the third person, but the first person. He is not focused on the Gentile nations. He's focused on the Jewish nations. And the language switches from Aramaic back to what? Hebrew. Chapter 8 is the vision of the ram and the goat. Ram being Persia, which followed Babylon. Goat being Greece, which followed Persia. And then chapter 9 is the 70 weeks prophecy, which we may never get out of. In fact, we may be in the 70 weeks prophecy longer than Daniel was. Because that prophecy reveals the time to the day that Jesus showed up in his triumphal entry. It reveals a gap of time that we're in now and a final 7 years of history that is yet to come. And then finally, Daniel in chapters 10 through 12 has his final vision, chapter 10 being the spiritual warfare chapter, and then the vision moves from the time of Daniel into the intertestamental period. It leapfrogs our age and goes into the tribulation in the millennial kingdom. It's his final vision from God. So the flow of the book in terms of the succession of Gentile powers is Babylon is in power first. 605 to 539, the two prominent Babylonian kings are first of all Nebuchadnezzar and later Belshazzar. And then there is a sea change politically. As Daniel predicted would happen, Babylon is overthrown by the Persians in a single night. And that political sea change happens in Daniel 5. And then the Persians come to power, and then Darius is prominent, and then Cyrus. That's the flow of the book. This chart here will help you keep which empire is in place at what, in which chapter. Chapters 1 through 4, the king that's in place is Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Chapter 5, Belshazzar of Babylon is the featured subject. Chapter 6, the king that threw Daniel into the lion's den is now Darius of Media Persia. Chapter 7 and 8, Belshazzar of Babylon is in power. Chapter 9, when Daniel had the prophecy of the 70 weeks, Darius of Media Persia was in power. And then when Daniel had his final prophecy, Cyrus of Media Persia is in power. Chapters 10 through 12. There's a sea change between Babylon being overtaken by the Persians in a single night, Daniel chapter 5. You say, well, wait a minute, this is out of order. Babylon, Babylon, Medo-Persia. Wait, 7 and 8 go back to Babylon. Chapter 9 goes back to Media-Persia. Chapters 10 through 12 goes back to Media-Persia. And you're right, it is out of order. Because the book of Daniel is not structured chronologically, it is structured what? Chiastically. See, we want everything to start here and end there. That's how the Western mind works. That's not the way the Bible is written many times. That's not the way the Aramaic chiasm is written. Embedded chronology. Believe it or not, I'm getting close to finishing. Hang in there. There are several places where a date is given. Daniel 1:1, third year of Jehoiakim, 605. Daniel 2:1, second year of Nebuchadnezzar, 603. Daniel 5 happened October the 12th, 539 BC. How do I know that? Because my professor Harold Honer, one of the greatest chronologists that ever lived, figured that out. Read his book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, and you'll see his proof. Chapter 7, verse 1, the first year of Belshazzar, 553. Daniel 8, 1, the third year of Belshazzar, 551. Daniel 9, 1, first year of Darius, 538. Daniel 10, 1, third year of Cyrus, 536. Wait a minute, hold the phone. Chapter 7 and 8 are what? Out of order. It goes 605, 603, 539, then it goes back to what? 553, it goes back up. Why are 7 and 8 out of order? Because the book is not structured chronologically. It's structured chiastically. Good class. Excellent. Daniel served through two empires, pagan empires. And when you put the whole thing together, he served two Babylonian kings and two Persian kings. That was Daniel's career, which lasted about 70 years. He served under four different administrations. Was he tempted to compromise? You bet. But he remained faithful to God no matter where he was and who he was serving. And God honored him, which is the message for us. So the last point is, if we can figure out this embedded chronology, we can figure out Daniel's age. Most believe that Daniel was taken into captivity as a very young man, about the age of 15, in Daniel 1. Daniel 2 happens 2 years later, which means he was about 17. And I'm just following the chronology that I showed you on this chart here. When his friends are thrown in the fiery furnace, he's probably 19 or 20. When he interprets Nebuchadnezzar's second dream, chapter 4, he's probably somewhere between 45 to 50. When Daniel 5 happens and Persia overthrows Babylon in what we call the handwriting on the wall chapter, he's probably in his early 80s. When he's delivered from the lion's den, he's 83 years old. So all of these pictures you see about Daniel in the lion's den with biceps out to here, looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger. All that is false. He was not thrown into the lion's den as a young man. He was frail and old, and he had no one to depend upon but God. And guess what position you're in when you've got no one else to depend upon but God? You're in the best position you could be in. But wait a minute, hold the phone. Now we're back down to his 60s, chapter 7 and 8. Then we go back to his early 80s, when he has the 70 weeks prophecy, and then when he has the final vision in his mid-80s. Why does it go from 80s to 60s to 80s? Because 7 and 8 are out of order, because the book is not structured chronologically. The book is structured chiastically. Excellent. And by the way, just as a little application here, a lot of you people think you're too old to be used by God. We call that retirement. Oh, I've done that. God's finished using me. As long as there is breath in your body, God wants to use you. Doesn't matter how old you are. Can I say one other thing? It doesn't matter how young you are. He was used by God as a 15-year-old. And he had his greatest visions in his mid to late 80s. And by the way, the pattern that he had as a 15-year-old, no compromise, followed him into his old age. Because we have a mindset today among young people that says this: oh, I'm just going to sow a few wild oats. I'm going to compromise a little bit, and then I'm going to get serious about God. Beloved, it doesn't work that way. Whatever stance you're taking as a young person, that becomes part of your character, which will follow you in terms of your habits of living until old age. This is what we need to be telling young people. Stand for God now while you're young, because it will formulate the right character, which will allow you to stand for God later. A lot of people ask me, Andy, why are you the way you are? And I've thought about that. Why am I the way that I am? The reason is because, as a very young person, I heard the gospel. I didn't waste any time. I got serious about it. And there were certain decisions that became part of who I am, which largely explains who I am today. And I wonder how different I would be if I lived in compromise all those years. So that is a little bit of background on the book of Daniel. I hope you're looking forward to this study. And we're going to begin a verse-by-verse teaching of it. Shall we pray? Father, we're grateful for the book of Daniel and the way it speaks to us in our lives. Be with us as a flock and as a congregation as we travel through this very ancient book. And you teach us things about our time period, how to live, prophecy, and the wonderful truths that you have for us. We'll be careful to give you all the praise and the glory. We lift these things up in Jesus' name, and God's people said,